They were taking down the command post near the Towers of Silence so that they could move the men closer to Chowpatty Beach to sort through the carnage. The toll so far was 46 dead, including the 10 Mujahideen killed on the beach. Injuries ran in the thousands, mostly shrapnel wounds. Marine Drive was closed off, and additional troops had been called in to cordon off the parade route while bomb squads scoured for undetonated explosives. The crowd had been dispersed, with Kamala Nehru Park set up as a way station for those who'd been separated from loved ones during the course of the mayhem. As for Derry Neshaw, the word was that he had been nearly captured at Abdul Jahan's film studio after slaying both Jahan and the woman who'd aided in his escape from Khatyam. It was presumed he was on his way to rendezvous with whatever of his force remained with the second Sabre missile launcher. On that front, inspections at several film sites in Rajasthan had turned up nothing. The search was still on. Najib Wall was within hearing distance of the command post, but he had tuned out the updates. His focus was on the nearest tower, where his uncle's deposition had been carried out only a few moments before. Now the pavilion was empty, as were most of the folding chairs set out in the adjacent park. With all that had happened, attending Zirat Wall's service had become a low priority for most and deemed a security risk for the president and prime minister, who had been put aboard one of the surveillance helicopters and spirited away to safer ground. Their planned eulogies would no doubt be delivered later, far from the Towers of Silence. Not that Wall minded. His uncle, after all, had been a very private man and would probably have disapproved of all the attention. This way was fine. A favorite nephew bidding farewell to his favorite uncle. Nice and simple. For the ceremony, Wall had brought along two items, both from the academy and Khatyam. He stared at them thoughtfully. The portrait of Zirat Wall in his military regalia after the liberation of Bangladesh, and the painting of him sitting beside his young nephew, who all those years ago looked out at the world with an eager confidence. The sound of flapping wings drew Wall's attention from the portraits to the clear blue sky above the tower. The vultures were on their way. To Wall, they looked small. Thar Desert, north of Jodhpur. From the moment orders had gone out to begin searching Abdul Jahan's film sites in Rajasthan, the maddening shell game had been at the mercy of the weather. For all their sophistication, the Orion spy satellite and India's various orbiting UAVs were of limited use when it came to peering through monsoons. Similarly, a collaborative field force made up of the Indian military, IB, CIA, Secret Service, and Rajasthan National Guard had given deference to the storm in determining which sites they would search first. They'd begun in the eastern part of the state, ahead of the storm, coming up empty at four different sites. To the west, another contingent had hunkered down as the torrents passed overhead. The Mujahideen, meanwhile, had found the monsoon to be their saving grace, as the staging locale for Moon Over Mars was located mid-state, and other than aerial surveillance by recon planes, the authorities had yet to take their ground search to Jodhpur. 20 miles north of the former capital, a 5-acre tract of the Thar Desert had been converted to a lunar landscape, mostly by way of prefab whirlpool tubs embedded in the sand, then partially filled with sand and layered with taupe plaster until they could pass for moon craters. A Quonset hut was dressed up to pass for the main base of the moon colony, and the colonists' main form of ground transportation were low-slung, unarmed desert patrol vehicles, painted the same metallic silver as the hut. The DPVs were bought at a military auction, along with the handful of rust-colored U.S. LVTP-7 amphibious tractors, representing the formidable Martian invasion force. As was common in movie making, scenes were scheduled to be filmed out of sequence, and the first day's footage would actually appear at the end of the picture, given, of course, the mistaken assumption that the Mujahideen had any interest in adhering to the dummy production schedule once they'd used the site to mask their release of the Sabre warheads. There were nearly 60 extras on the set, suited up as warring factions. It was easy enough to tell who was who. The Martians wore crimson-dyed Geely sniper suits, jackets and helmets covered with tattered material so that they looked like a cross between mountain yaks and devils with dreadlocks. Opposing them were the noble colonists, sweltering inside their surplus World War II SOE jumpsuits. There'd been a problem getting the silver spray paint to stick to the fabric of both the suits and helmets, and through the camera viewfinders, it looked as if their outfits were made of aluminum foil. Of the 60 men, less than half were mujahideen. The rest were bona fide extras, plucked from the streets of Jodhpur during an impromptu casting call, during which prospective actors were briefly interviewed to weed out anyone of passing intelligence. The mujahideen wanted dullards, men who wouldn't ask too many questions as they were moved around the sand like chess pieces to give the impression a battle scene was being choreographed for cinematic posterity. The extras may have been simpletons, but they understood the concept of flash flood, and there were grumblings as they glanced nervously westward at the black clouds crossing the desert toward them. How long would the filming take, they wondered. Would they be taken to high ground once the storm hit? Did they get paid extra for working under bad weather conditions? Bawan, the top-ranking mujahideen at the site, quickly took control of the situation. He picked out the extra who was doing the most complaining, paid him the agreed-upon fee for his services, then told him to take off his outfit and go home. Since it was 20 miles back to Jodhpur, the man had a sudden change of heart and decided perhaps he would stick around for the shooting after all. The others fell in line, and the mutiny was quickly quelled. 6 minutes later, an Antonov AN-12 cargo plane dropped below the cloud line and came to a landing on a flat stretch of desert adjacent to the film site. Stenciled on the rear tail fin was a large J in the shape of a flexing bicep, the logo for Jahan Filmworks. The Antonov, a one-time Aeroflot workhorse, had an upswept tail to accommodate its rear-loading ramp, and by the time the mujahideen posing as prop masters reached the plane, the cargo crew was already unloading the fanciful shell for the colonists' war tank. They'd gone ahead and affixed the shell to a Humvee, allowing them to drive it down the ramp. Behind the tank was a late-model Dodge Ram pickup, its rear bed stacked with smaller clip-on attachments designed to give a futuristic look to a range of 50-caliber and 7.62mm machine guns. While Bawan was signing off on the delivery, the cargo foreman asked if it would be possible for his crew to stick around and watch some of the filming. Bawan's first reaction was to tell the man that wasn't possible, because the plane would be in the way of some of the shots. But when he glanced up the ramp and saw that there was room inside for all his men, he decided the Antonov might be a more useful and less conspicuous escape vehicle than the Aerospace Line's Guppy that was doubling as the Martian warship. Bawan made a deal with the cargo carriers. They could watch the filming for a few minutes, provided they would then board their craft and have it ready to take off at a moment's notice, in case the monsoon hit. The cargo foreman glanced back at the storm front and figured that gave them a good half hour. Bawan indicated an area they could watch from without getting in anyone's way, then headed off to assist in the delivery of the new props.
Incidentally, under no circumstances are you allowed anywhere near the white tent. It is the stars' quarters, and you do not care to be disturbed while they are preparing their rolls.
The cargo foreman nodded and promised his men would keep their distance. There was room in the back of the pickup for Bawan. He climbed aboard and signaled for the driver to circle around the costumed Hummer and lead the way to the tent. On the way, he checked his watch. Half an hour was cutting it close. They would have to work fast. The tent, flapping in the wind, was large, covering 5,000 square feet. Backed up to one of the side panels was an eight-wheel truck with the Jahan logo emblazoned on its side. Bawan directed the Dodge around to the other side, where two more mujahideen held open flaps to create an opening for both the pickup and Hummer. Inside the tent, there were neither film stars nor any of the amenities they would have likely demanded for having to endure the discomfort of desert filming. Instead, there were three wooden crates, one packed with M60 machine guns, another with shorter-barreled 50-caliber weapons. The third crate, by far the longest, contained four Sabre surface-to-air missiles. The Kashmiris who'd opened the tentfold quickly returned to their task, taking machine guns from the crates and affixing them to their mounts on one of the desert patrol vehicles. Once the attachments were clamped over them, the guns would, like the DPV, look like space props. Hopefully, there would be time to bring the other vehicles in for retrofitting before it was time to launch the missiles. Bawan climbed out of the pickup and dropped the tailgate, then crossed over to where the missile launcher was being eased down a loading ramp from the rear of the eight-wheeler.
Quickly! We have only 20 minutes to disguise the launcher and load it! The firing is to begin at 1500 hours sharp!
Bawan lent a hand, helping to unfasten the tank casing from the Humvee. He and the others were carrying the shell over to the rocket launcher when they heard over the flapping of the tent's canvas the sound of an approaching aircraft.
Damn it! Everyone stop what you're doing and arm yourselves!
Bawan snatched an M60 from one of the crates and hurried out of the tent, ready to fend off whoever it was who dared intrude upon their mission. His urgency faded, however, when he recognized Abdul Jahan's private helicopter and, more importantly, the man who was riding in the passenger seat. Bawan set the M60 aside and rushed to the chopper as it set down on the hard pan near the white tent.
Gary!
Neshaw climbed out, ducking to avoid the rotors as he jogged away from the chopper, which lifted off and headed toward Jodhpur, where the pilot planned to wait out the storm before returning to Bombay. By some quirk of fate, Neshaw let the man live.
You made it! How did we fare in Bombay?
Neshaw stared solemnly at Bawan and shook his head. While in the air, he'd monitored newscasts over the radio and learned of Shili's failure to take out the president and prime minister. Without mentioning the still-present saber threat, both leaders had given a brief statement saying that they were going to focus their fullest efforts on eradicating the Mujahideen threat in India and getting Pakistan to renounce its ties to the insurgents.
Our backs are to the wall. We must succeed here, or we are finished.
I understand. But if we do succeed here, everything will change. We will yet have our chance at glory.
A number of caravan routes fanned out northward from Jodhpur, most of them used by tourists taking day trips into the desert so they could, at least in their own minds, have a taste of what it must have been like to have been Lawrence of Arabia. Only two of the routes continued as far as the movie set, one used by tourists hardy enough for a week-long trek to Jaisalmer, the other part of an ancient trail long used by merchants shuttling their wares from city to city north of the Aravalli mountain range. Mac Bolan, John Kissinger, and Jack Grimaldi had decided on the latter route. To any Mujahideen lookouts posted along the trail, it would make sense that merchants, rather than tourists, would continue to venture along the trail despite an approaching monsoon that stirred up clouds of dust, reducing visibility every bit as much as a snow blizzard in the Himalayas. By the same token, one would expect the camels in a merchant caravan to be loaded with wares. The men could pack their weapons and other munitions without drawing undue notice. There were 40 camels in the procession, trotting across the sand in single file, less than a yard between one and the next. Only 13 of the humped beasts bore riders. The other 27 were heavily laden with cargo. All in all, it was the same sort of formation that had religiously passed by the film site every day at this time. Same number of riders, same amount of cargo, same slow, deliberate pace. The Stony Man warriors weren't among those astride the camels. Along with a dozen members of the Rajasthan Desert Militia, Bolan, Kissinger, and Grimaldi rode alongside the far side of the beast's humps, each man lying on his side within the webbing of a woven rope cargo sling. There were more comfortable ways to travel, to be sure. With each step the camels took, the rope chafed against the men's skin and clothing like a blunt, bristly-edged knife. And, too, they were facing the sun, and there was enough of it streaking through the sweeping dust clouds to make the men feel as if they were being roasted on a spit. There was a reason for the ploy, of course. At one point, the trail not only wound to within 100 yards of the film site, but it also passed behind a sand dune 15 feet high and nearly 45 yards across. The dune would provide the men the cover behind which they could make their move. As soon as he heard one of the camel drivers trill on a panpipe, Mac Bolan unsheathed the trench knife and cut through enough of the webbing to free one arm. He reached up over the camel's hump, grabbing hold of a thicker length of rope knotted around the saddle pommel. He quickly untied the knot and yanked on the rope, pulling over a saddlebag weighed down with two 20-pound sacks of flour. He did the same with one more pouch, then hacked some more at the sling webbing until, like a moth wriggling from its cocoon, he was able to crawl free. All the while, he continued to hold on to the mesh, however, and it wasn't until he'd dragged over another three saddle packs that he let go, leaving the camel's load properly counterweighted. He stepped back and slapped the camel's hindquarters to urge it along, then joined Kissinger, Grimaldi, and the RDM soldiers, all of whom had similarly cut themselves loose, and proceeded to the dune. An RDM sniper quickly broke out a Priva mechanical crossbow and began to assemble it. The weapon was similar to the Barnett Commando, which Bolan had used with success on a number of missions, but this was the RDM's turf, and he was content to let their man do the honors of taking out the nearest Mujahideen sentry. It left him free to see what they were in for should they be able to reach the film site. Grimaldi and Kissinger joined him as he peered over the top of the dune. All three men wore wraparound goggles to keep the stinging sand from their eyes. Grimaldi caught a glimpse of the costumed extras who were easy to see through the dust clouds.
What a goofy-ass batch of spacemen. They look like rejects from the last Power Rangers movie.
Bolin peered through his binoculars.
There are at least 40 of them. Goofy-looking or not, if they're all Mujahideen, we're in for a fight.
And who knows how many others might be hanging out in the plains. That guppy could hold a good 20, 30 guys.
Those space rifles they're carrying look like the real deal. M50s in sheep's clothing, I think.
I was wondering about that. Those DPVs coming out of that tent look like they've strapped on some real heat, too.
Bolin was concerned about the sandstorm. Sure, it gave them some extra cover, but it would also hinder the approach of backup forces and possibly work against them if things turned into a firefight. The Mujahideen, after all, were more familiar with the film site and could use the knowledge to their favor. Moments later, the main flaps to the white tent parted, and out rolled a futuristic-looking tank, perhaps two-thirds the size of the crimson LVTP-7 Amtraks. Six men walked out alongside the weapon. Attempting to focus on them through the binoculars was like trying to pull in a television station with a weak signal. The airborne sand obscured everything in sight. Whether it was something about the way the men carried themselves, or the fact that none of them wore costumes, Bolin felt in his gut that these were more than mere grips hauling out another prop. One man seemed to be in charge, and he moved about the tank, gesticulating at the others to make sure they positioned it correctly. From this distance and through the sandstorm, it was impossible to get a good look at the man's face, but Bolin recognized the hand gestures and gait from video footage he'd studied back at the farm.
Nisha. Front guy on the right.
How can you be sure?
It's him.
In that case, my money says his little space tank is our missing saber launcher.
Yep, we're in business.
Should we just rush him?
I don't think so. They've got home court advantage. We'd only be playing into their hands.
Well, we can't just inch forward every time we manage to take out a sentry. If they're aiming to get off a few missiles before the storm hits, we need to beat them to the punch.
Agreed. But there's got to be a better way than just charging into their guns.
Kissinger patted his knapsack.
I could lob a hairball. If I miss a launcher, I might at least hit the tent, and I'll give you 10-1 it's not fireproof.
I like the idea, but I'd rather we got closer, so the wind's not working so much against you.
How about the cargo plane?
Grimaldi pointed to the aircraft, less than 80 yards to their right on the other side of the dune.
What about it?
Grimaldi quickly laid out the plan he had in mind. When he was finished, Kissinger and Bolin exchanged a look.
It's worth a shot.
All right.
Just wait until the first sentry goes down.
No problem.
They didn't have long to wait. The RDM sniper had finished assembling his Priva MC. Aside from the actual crossbow, the weapon bore little resemblance to its medieval counterpart. With a full-fledged stock, foregrip, trigger, and shoulder stock, it looked more like a submachine gun equipped with handlebars. Once he'd tautened the bowstring and fitted a bolt into the receiver, the sniper lined up his sights and drew a bead on the Mujahideen sentry, who had his back to the sandstorm and was hunched over, hands cupped to his face as he tried to light a cigarette. The crossbow shaft suddenly sprouted from his neck, dropping him to the sand.
All right, let's go.
Along with the RDM, the three Stony Man warriors cleared the rise and charged quietly down the other side of the dune. Grimaldi quickly veered to his right, heading for the cargo plane. Bolin and Kissinger, on the other hand, jogged left, their destination, one of the red LVTP-7 Amtraks, parked close by the guppy. As he watched the disguised saber system being taken through its pre-launch checks, Derry Neshaw stared out at the film site. If they were actually filming, he mused, the sandstorm would have been a good effect. It gave the set an otherworldly feel and made the costumes and props all look a little less garish. Ironically, the script, an amateurish student effort Briley had secured for the Mujahideen by sleeping with a film school instructor back in London, had mentioned something about the final conflict taking place in a swirl of mysterious gas emitted by the moon craters. It wasn't the only parallel between the script and the potential real-life events. In the movie, the overmatched moon colonists were on the verge of extermination when they made their final stand against the Martian invaders, triumphing thanks to the so-called transquasar recombinant energy cannon the hero had managed to create out of odds and ends scavenged from a lunar scrapyard. Neshaw and the Mujahideen had gotten their hands on her pre-built launcher, coming up with a way to disguise and fire it without enemy detection. When the countdown was completed and the missiles were launched, their cannon would inevitably turn the tide of battle in their favor. Even if the enemy sent out interceptors, it was unlikely that they would be able to take out more than one or two of the missiles. The others would hit their mark, and the finger pointing would begin. India and Pakistan would goad each other like rabid dogs. Neshaw and the others, meanwhile, would board the cargo plane and fly to Kashmir, where they would wait patiently while New Delhi and Islamabad annihilated each other. After that, well, they would see. Neshaw turned to Bawan.
How much longer?
Bawan conferred with the technician, who was busy establishing trajectory and target coordinates.
2 minutes to countdown.
Inside the front cabin of the cargo plane, the pilot smirked as he unscrewed his thermos and refilled his teacup. Through the windshield, he could see his fellow workers huddled close, backs to the storm as they stared out at the film site. How could they, after years of working behind the scenes, still see movie making as magical? Didn't they realize that shooting would likely be delayed if not postponed because of the weather? And even if the weather had been perfect, they could spend the whole day here without witnessing anything like the final product that wound up on the screen. The war scenes they watched would consist of, at most, a few minutes of filmed action, followed by hours of idle time as sets were moved and the lighting and sound crew moved in to tinker with all their gizmos until the director was satisfied that everything was just right, at which point they'd shoot another fraction of a scene and then begin the process again, all over. Let them suffer, he thought. He'd sit up here in the air-conditioned cockpit and enjoy his tea. He heard the cabin door open. He hadn't bothered to lock it. There was no reason to. Jack Grimaldi stepped into the cockpit and aimed his grisly pistol at the astonished pilot.
Step aside, Clyde. I've always wanted to take one of these babies for a spin.
Bolin and Kissinger were halfway to the nearest amphibious tractor when one of the retrofitted DPVs appeared out of the nearest sand cloud and roared to a stop. Both men dived as rounds tore through the sand where they'd been standing. Lying on the ground, Bolin brought his Desert Eagle into target acquisition. One shot found its mark, striking the driver just below the helmet. Kissinger, meanwhile, continued rolling as 7.62mm rounds chased him across the desert floor. When there was a lull in the firing, he bounded to his feet and emptied his Colt at the tail gunner. The Mujahideen took a trio of 9mm slugs across the upper chest and slumped against the roof rack. Two desert militia soldiers joined in the fray, but their shots were wasted, plowing into men who were already dead. Bolin signaled for them to go ahead and take the DPV, indicating that he and Kissinger wanted dibs on the Amtrak. The LVTP-7 was little more than an armor-plated carrier mounted on treads. Unlike a tank, its turret wasn't fitted with a cannon, but rather a meager 12.7mm machine gun, and that gun was absent from this Amtrak. Helpful to Bolin and Kissinger, however, was the outer prop shell, which provided them with a 3-foot-high wall behind which to hide. While Bolin stood watch, Kissinger hurriedly set out his DHL and began to assemble it. The men thought the vehicle was unmanned, and both were surprised when the turret's hatch suddenly swung open. Bolin whirled about and was ready to fire when he saw a man climb out with his hands held high in surrender.
Nice call. Now, if only your buddies would follow suit.
Neshaw shielded the stinging dust from his face with one hand while he unholstered his pistol with the other. The shooting was taking place slightly downhill, beyond the guppy and the farthest of the Amtraks, and there was little he could see but the clouds of sand. The extras, of course, were either cowering in the sand or running in all directions like frightened children. But Neshaw's men, he was proud to see, had responded quickly to the intrusion. He saw them, blurry silhouettes of red and silver, plodding through the sandstorm toward the action, firing their M60s. Then, atop the farthest of the tractor tents, Neshaw saw the upper torso of a Mujahideen holding his arms held high in surrender. Enraged, the Kashmiri raised his weapon, drew aim at the Amtrak, and fired. The man atop the vehicle twisted to one side and dangled briefly over the side of the raised wall, then tumbled down to the ground.
Coward! No retreat! No surrender!
Neshaw saw movement to his left and turned. The cargo plane had begun to move. Instead of heading down the makeshift runway, the plane turned slightly and began to move toward the set. The cargo's employees, who'd been standing nearby admiring the realistic action, glanced over their shoulders and scattered as the plane rolled past them,
Begin the countdown.
But we have to finish the pre-launch.
I said begin the countdown.
Nesha slammed a fresh magazine into the handle of his Taisho pistol.
Tack on a few seconds if you have to, but move it up. Go.
He turned to Bawan, now his second in command.
We have to stop that plane.
Bawan nodded. One of the desert patrol vehicles was emerging from the tent, newly outfitted with its decorated machine guns. Bawan stepped in front of the vehicle and motioned for the driver and tail gunner to get out.
I'll drive.
That left Bawan to take the rear gunner position. He was only halfway into the caged quarters when Nesha put the DPV into gear and pulled away. Now they began to see some of the enemy approaching. Bawan stopped a few RDM foot soldiers in their tracks with a burst of rounds. Then, materializing out of the smoke, they saw camels. Their riders, RDM cavalry soldiers, no longer masquerading as caravan merchants, had doubled back at the first exchange of gunfire. Armed with MP5s, they fired down at the costumed Mujahideen. One of the camels was hit by return fire and toppled headfirst into the sand, throwing its rider from the saddle. Nesha veered the DPV and passed alongside the fallen militia officer. He slowed long enough to put his gun to the man's head and pull the trigger. In slowing, however, he'd also allowed other RDM troopers to take aim at the patrol vehicle. Bawan took the worst of it, dying in the gunner's post with shots through the head and upper torso. Nesha felt a slug lodge in his shoulder, but tried to ignore the pain. Hands on the steering wheel, he drove on, heading toward the approaching plane. As he smashed the cargo plane through a length of cyclone fence and bore down on the missile launcher, Grimaldi kept reminding himself of Kissinger's assurances that the missiles most likely wouldn't detonate if crushed under the moving bulk of the Antonov. Now he wished Cowboy had been a little more specific. What kind of odds did most likely amount to? As if this weren't a troubling enough distraction, Grimaldi now saw a desert patrol vehicle emerging from the storm clouds and bearing down on him. The DPV could never hope to win a head-on collision, but if it managed to clip the Antonov's front wheel at the right angle, Grimaldi knew it could well thwart his chances of reaching the launcher before it fired its missiles.
This should be interesting.
By the time Kissinger had assembled his Dragon's Hairball launcher, a lull had settled over the film site. The wind had died down, dropping sand from the air and giving a clear view of the short-term carnage that had been wreaked thus far. There were bodies everywhere. Thankfully, no one had emerged from the guppy, and the men from Stony Man Farm hoped it stayed that way. Kissinger was about to draw aim on the missile launcher when he saw Nesha racing toward the cargo plane in the DPV. A stunned extra in a colonist outfit found himself in the vehicle's path and tried to duck away. He chose the wrong direction, and the patrol vehicle sent him flying over the hood and up past the gunnery cage, where Bawan slumped dead behind the 7.62mm machine gun.
Can you take him out?
Easier said than done.
Kissinger had never tried firing the DHL at a moving target, and though the obvious strategy was to shoot ahead of the DPV in hopes the vehicle would drive into the path of the incendiary load, if he overshot the target, he stood a greater chance of hitting the Antonov and turning Grimaldi into toast.
Just take your best shot.
Kissinger drew in a deep breath and slowly pulled the trigger. The DHL slammed into his shoulder as it fired. Both he and Bolin watched the charge converge on the patrol vehicle. Erring on the side of caution, Kissinger had aimed short, striking the ground several yards behind Nesha. However, on impact, the resultant fireball rolled forward, carried by momentum, and fanned out as it engulfed the rear end of the DPV. All it took was one flicker to the fuel tank, and the patrol vehicle exploded, stopping in its tracks. Nesha was killed instantly. As smoke rose from the fiery remains of the DPV, Bolin and Kissinger watched Grimaldi bear down on the missile launcher. The countdown was into its final seconds, and through his binoculars, Bolin could see one of the Mujahideen raise his right hand and, one by one, retract his fingers. 5, 4, 3, 2. The counter looked up, eyes widening in terror as he saw the nose of the Antonov sweep over him. The prop firing tubes snapped like celery stalks, sending the missiles sliding from their racks into the sand. Kissinger would have collected in Vegas because, as he'd predicted, none of the warheads detonated, even when the disabled launcher was dragged across them by the cargo plane. Within seconds after the aircraft came to a halt, the monsoon swept across the film site and the heavens opened up. Rain pounded the sand. Bolin and Kissinger bounded down from the Amtrak, and began helping the desert militia round up the surviving extras and Mujahideen. Contrary to their leader's orders, the remaining Kashmiris readily surrendered. They knew it was over. Epilogue. Stony Man Farm, Virginia. Unlike Zarat Wall, the men of Stony Man Farm received neither medals nor parades to honor their valor and courage on the field of battle. As they touched down on the farm's camouflaged runway in the private Cessna that had brought them from Dulles International Airport, the most Mac Bolan, Jack Grimaldi, and John Kissinger were hoping for was a decent meal and hopefully a good night's sleep before their next call to arms. A few farmhands doing chores in the nearby orchard glanced up and offered the men faint nods as they deplaned. Other than that, the only other people who'd come out to welcome them back were Hal Brognola, Aaron Kurtzman, and Barbara Price. After warm, if perfunctory, greetings were exchanged, the six headed on foot toward the main house. Brognola and Kurtzman pigeonholed Grimaldi and Kissinger, pressing them for details about the mission, leaving Bolan and Price to walk alone a few steps behind. As always, in the name of propriety, they walked a distance apart from each other. Bolan and Price both had an unspoken pact not to make a public issue of their relationship. At times like this, it wasn't easy, however. Price had anxiously monitored the turmoil the men had faced, and she could see that Bolan had brought back fresh scars from the war zone. There were certain things a woman wanted to do with a man after their separation was marked by a brush with death. For his part, Bolan, despite his fatigue, felt a familiar stirring at the smell of Price's hair in the late summer breeze. Sure, he was exhausted, but there would be time for sleep. Later. They neared the main building where she maintained her living quarters.
It's Labor Day.
Slipped my mind completely.
I've always been fond of picnics on Labor Day.
Bolan glanced up at the sky. Dark clouds were gathering. Nothing as severe as what he'd seen in India, but threatening nonetheless.
Looks like rain.
Then I guess we'll just have to do our picnicking indoors.
I like the way you think.
Mac Bolan, Sworn Enemies is a graphic audio production. Mac Bolan is a trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2002, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Jeff Baker, Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Casey Jones, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Thomas Penny, and Mort Shelby. Additional redshirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Nanette Savard. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Kyle Unaver, Christian Parent, Nathaniel Perry, and Matt Webb. The Mac Bolan theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Additional original music by Matt Webb, Nathaniel Perry, and Chris Rowan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Mac Bolan, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Stony Man and The Executioner, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for previews of other graphic audio thrillers.
The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Deathstalker Honor, Episode 5, Cry Havoc. The armies of Shub have come to the harsh mining planet Loki. The overextended parliament of the New Republic can only send the legendary hero Jack Random and his loose cannon companion Ruby Journey to do their damnedest with the powers they've acquired from the Madness Maze.
Can't say I like the odds. 1,000 to 2 is just a little worrying.
But when they get to the mining planet, they find the colony engaged in a civil war with the representative government in the hands of unsavory profiteers who are at war with justifiably aggrieved rebel forces. who have unjustifiably allied themselves with Shub.
Say we take control of Vidar and then Loki. You think Shub is just going to pull its forces out and leave us to get on with running things? What's to stop them from just slaughtering us all?
Weary to the point of despair with the moral ambiguities with which he is constantly presented, Jack Random takes a dangerous path and begins brandishing his own form of justice, eventually leading to a mortal confrontation with an old and very familiar enemy.
Well, well, here we all are again. Funny how we keep bumping into each other, isn't it?
After barely escaping the destruction of a redoubt in the Deathlands' New Southwest, the companions search for another gateway.
We'll head west and just hope our luck holds.
But without adequate supplies, the situation looks grim.
Name's Ryan Carter. Got 3 men and 2 women. We were heading for the Grand D when the flash flood took our horses.
We're good Christian folks here, Mr. Carter. If you and your friends would like to come in, you're right welcome to share any victuals we got.
Ryan strikes a deal with the leader of a wagon train heading west. The companions will provide protection against all attackers in exchange for food and water.
I'm the Reverend Vare. We accept your offer. Please join us.
But there's a baron with a disturbing name who holds the power in this part of the Deathlands.
It's Skullface!
Oh, God. No. Not him. Not again. Not again! Why, God, why?
And he wears a horrifyingly familiar face.
Did you miss me, Carter? Got anything to say? Last words, that sort of thing?
No.
Good enough. Time to die, One Eye.
And this confrontation with an old and bitter enemy will end in a battle to the death. Deathlands number 12, Latitude Zero.
Despite the efforts of law enforcement from the U.S. and other countries, Panama is still a pipeline for illegal drugs. Mac Bolan, his brother Johnny, and lady-fed Keely Ross are out to plug a tributary of that pipeline.
There's the objective.
It's a cocaine refinery, all right. I can smell it from here.
So, we're clear on the plan?
Crystal.
Let's blow it up.
Okay, move out.
Reverend Flash, move in! We are under fire!
But their ultimate target is much bigger than one coke factory.
What is happening, Mr. Sun? Why can't you stop these attacks?
Mr. President, please. I have guaranteed your safety unconditionally. No one can find you here.
Maxwell Reed, would-be president of the small Caribbean nation of Isla de Victoria. His plans for a violent takeover of the elected government are bankrolled by a coalition of international crime lords with their own plans for the island.
We have a problem. Somebody is trying to bring us down.
We don't know who they are, Mr. Brody.
There is a way of finding out.
Which is?
Capture one of them and squeeze him until he sinks.
The search for Reed takes Bolan and his colleagues from the steaming jungles of Panama to the luxurious resorts of the Bahamas.
Borodine is somewhere in this hotel. If we can get Borodine, he can lead us to Reed.
This isn't going to be easy.
Is it ever?
Johnny, Keely, hold up. I'm going to try to clear a path.
It's your dime. Talk to me.
We have a problem.
What?
Mac's gone.
Executioner number 309, Flames of Fury, part 2 of the Org Crime Trilogy. From Graphic Audio. Bolan and the operatives of Stony Man Farm must unravel the true secret behind a separatist plot on Okinawa.
Think of it. Okinawan citizens are attacked and killed by U.S. soldiers with guns in the night. It will be a priceless opportunity.
It would be a political blow the Americans would almost never recover from.
These guys that attacked us weren't Okinawans. They were Korean Special Forces commanding the native separatists.
What are Korean Special Forces doing on Okinawa?
That's a damn good question.
Okinawa is certainly a chess piece they'd like to see the U.S. lose.
That's why they're trying to destabilize Okinawa. If we were forced out, it would cost the United States and Japan billions to build new bases elsewhere.
They have a neutron bomb, and they're going to light it off in Okinawa and blame it on us. They're going to kill half the citizens and most of the U.S. soldiers stationed on it. In one shot, the United States is going to lose its military influence west of Hawaii.
This isn't about Okinawan independence. It's about genocide. It'll be the biggest frame-up of all time.
And the executioner must seek help from an unlikely ally.
Your country needs you, Sergeant.
I used to be a sergeant, goddammit.
You used to be a hell of a soldier until you started selling Stinger missiles to the Korean mob. You're a traitor, Burdick, but I'm giving you a chance to serve your country again and repair your tarnished career.
That's over, Stryker. You saw to that.
MacFarlane number 85, Breakaway. 7 unabridged hours in graphic audio.
MacFarlane 86, Blood and Sand. The pursuit of justice against global terrorism is about to become a double-edged sword as vengeance-seeking French billionaire Dante Marquis turns personal retribution into a machine of blood and madness. With a mercenary army and a network of justice insiders on his payroll, he's launching a worldwide dragnet for Mohammed Hamad, the infamous terrorist who murdered his family. And thousands of innocents will die in Marquis's massive genocidal sweep.
Move it out, you people! Get a move on, you filth! Go!
Let him go?
Hell no! 30 to 40 marks, soldiers, women, and children, nice tight marble flesh. It doesn't get any better than this. Do them all!
Mac Bolan, independent agent for Stony Man Farm, will meet the threat with lethal force, sanctioned by the president for a double-barrel mission. Take down Marquis and his bounty-hunting operation, and strike a death blow to Hamad and his network of terrorist cells that stretches from Tunisia to San Francisco. Going undercover in the Frenchman's private army, the executioner will continue his pursuit of evil with some unexpected help.
Can you move?
I don't think anything's broken. You're one of them, aren't you? Go ahead and just shoot me then.
Wrong. I'm not one of them. I'm with me.
I just heard shooting.
That was me, shaving the odds.
You're after those mercenary bastards?
I don't have time to explain. Are your tourist friends still alive?
Last time I saw, yeah, but I'm no tourist.
What the hell are you?
CIA.
Have you judged me, Mr. Pollock, because I eliminate terrorist scum?
I have no problem with that.
I should hope not, because you are in the same game.
Not exactly. I don't go running around shooting innocent people.
They get what they deserved.
I sanction their execution. Me, Dante Marquis, because I have more money than God. I play God and I win. And that makes me God!
Don't miss one pulse-pounding minute of MacFarlane number 86, Blood and Sand.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.